All right, so we've come to Esther chapter 6. I wanted to make one comment in connection with a sort of an offhand comment I made last week. We were talking about allegorical interpretations, finding the Virgin Mary in Esther chapter 5, which is actually quite something to do. But in the middle of that, I made some reference to the early Roman Catholic seeing a fourfold sense of Scripture, and I made a vain attempt to remember one of the weirder words. So I put them on the board here. In Turretin's Institutes, you can find a discussion of this point, but he refers to the papists, as he calls them, seeing a fourfold sense in Scripture, literal, and then the last three are often classified together as mystical, but they are allegorical, anagogical, tropological. Those are the three. And in a sense, they're getting at a good point, which is that when we read Scripture, we should seek to see how it points forward to Christ, how we should apply it in our own lives, and what doctrinal teaching are there. But they actually insist that all four of those senses are the meaning of every verse, as opposed to seeking how you could find the meaning and then maybe apply it or tie it into the rest of Scripture. So allegorical, that term doesn't communicate very much, but it has to do with matters of faith. The anagogical has to do with things that look forward to the future, and the other category, tropological, has to do with morals, application to the way we should live. I'm not suggesting you take a lot from this, but since I broached the subject last time, I thought I would just mention that. If you want more information, you can look at Turretin, Topic 2, Question 19, or you could just forget about it. But anyway, that's what I was talking about last time. So we come to Esther chapter 6, and I will read the chapter. You'll remember that we ended the last chapter with Mordecai finding this one irritant which robs his whole life of joy, Haman finding this one irritant which robs his whole life of joy, which is seeing Mordecai sitting at the king's gate and not acknowledging the greatness of Haman. And so his wife and so-called friends counsel him to prepare a gallows for Mordecai and then go merrily with the king to the banquet, as it says. So that's the context of Esther chapter 6. That night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in. And the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" So Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning, and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before you, whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. I thought I would start the discussion of this with a quote from Matthew Henry, which I think he actually makes it at the, makes this comment at the end in verse 14, but I think it helps us keep in mind the whole point of the story very well. He says, "The wisdom of God is seen in timing the means of his church's deliverance so as to manifest his own glory." So we've talked again and again about how the book of Esther shows the providential hand of God, but not, you might say, the general providence, but a specific and oriented toward that special providence which has to do with the redemption and the Christ to come. In this case, the preservation of the promised seed until the Christ should come. And you can trace it back, if you like, to the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12, that God would make sure that in the seed of Abraham all the nations would be blessed. We've talked about lots of places where you could find that in Scripture. So here especially you see the wisdom of God displayed for the his own glory in ways that are very striking. We saw in the last chapter the wisdom that God gave to Esther to understand the king and her own situation and to prepare him for the request she was going to make. We're in between banquet number one and banquet number two, in which the king is being prepared by Esther for this great request. But although we should admire God's providence in giving Esther those gifts and in her opening into the king's presence, perhaps the wisdom of God is shown best of all in the book of Esther by the first sentence of chapter 6, "That night the king could not sleep." So God is glorified in using people to accomplish his purposes. God is glorified by working even with the evil intentions of people, as we'll see later on in the chapter. Sometimes God is glorified by robbing a king of his sleep. And we need to remember that and recognize God's hand in all things. Now, the king being robbed of his sleep might not seem so significant to us. I guess it wasn't too pleasant for Ahasuerus, but you remember at the end of the chapter that Haman prepared the gallows for Mordecai. And if, as you read through the chapter, you realize that Haman, unlike me sometimes when I have something and I sort of put it off, Haman was, he was ready to do this. He showed up early in the court. So in terms of Mordecai, that means there's no chance for intervention. No way to get a message to Esther, please save me, or as if he knew about it. There's no way to find out what's going to happen. It looks like Mordecai is doomed. Okay? And that's part of the point of this intervention at this time. That very night, the night before the day when Mordecai was going to be executed, the king couldn't sleep. That's the providence of God in working out his will in this, at this point in the story. Now, arguably, this is the turning point of the whole book. So the hinge, and people have analyzed the literary aspects and all these banquets and that sort of thing. I'm not going to go into that. But you can look at it from various points of view. But I think it's, if you think about it, chapter 6, verse 1 is really the central point of the book. The whole story turns around here. Haman, who, as far as he knew before chapter 6, was in the ascendancy, starts to sense that something is wrong, and by the end his friends and wife are telling him that he's doomed. So it's here at the very point where we might think things are out of control that the king cannot sleep. Now the reference here is to, in the rest of verse 1 is to these book of the records of the chronicles. The Persian monarchs, and I guess monarchs in general in the ancient world, were quite careful to keep records of what happened in their reigns. It was important for them to reward people who had done good That was a one way to keep from being assassinated, to keep people happy, you know, give them an incentive to care for you. And so it may not simply be to lull himself back to sleep that they read what would probably be the equivalent of the Congressional Record or something like that, or the tax code or something. It's supposedly, people who have actually read these things say it's terribly boring. But among all the other diversions which a king like Ahasuerus could have sought, he asked for the records to be read. Again, it's the providence of God, and further the providence of God that they turned to those pages. And all of the pages they could have read, in verse 2, they found written that Mordecai had uncovered this plot against the king. And you see, the account is piling up again and again the things that seem, if not unlikely, at least not certain. And here we have the coming to the revealing of how Mordecai had been faithful to the king in the past. Now, the writer of Esther had already told us about this event, how Mordecai had unveiled the plot and how he had not been honored in the outcome of that. But now it comes up again. So Mordecai, who had been patient, we discussed this when that came up earlier, Mordecai, who could well have said, you know, I'm not being recognized by my ruler for what I've done faithfully. And Mordecai might at this point have reflected that God's timing is just right. Because God waited until just the right moment for this to be revealed to him. So Mordecai's record is revealed to the king. And then the king asks what honor or dignity has been bestowed. So this is consistent with this explanation that the king is anxious to try to honor people who preserve his life. And the answer is, well, nothing has been done for him. The record shows nothing. So in verses 4 through 11, then, we have the encounter between the king Ahasuerus and Haman. So the king says, who is in the court? The king seems to be rather incapable of making decisions on his own, so he always has to have his counselors around him. So his first reaction is, okay, well, who can I ask for advice on this matter? Okay. And of course, Haman is there, bright and early, as I said, right? Just when the doors open, as it were, Haman is there because he has his own petition, which is to hang Mordecai on the gallows. Okay? And so there's this interchange where the king says, you know, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? There's some irony just in that because the king is not identifying whom he wants to honor, just like Haman didn't identify the Jews when he wanted them exterminated. Okay, so the same sort of vague proposal, you know, what should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And it goes on from there. Before we look at some of the details, I want to make some general comments. And the first is from the commentator Job says it this way. This is arguably the most ironically comic scene in the entire Bible. And there is a lot of comedy here, not the slapstick kind exactly, although you can imagine some things that might have happened, but it's a, you might say, a typically Jewish sort of ironic humor here. So here's Haman. Haman, when he hears a question like that, thinks of no one but himself. Of course. You know, who would the king delight to honor but me? And then, whoops, sorry, you got the wrong guy, and you have to go around honoring this other person, the one you are actually going to request the execution of. So we should recognize that that comedy in here. And this, I made this point early on in our study. We may not be used to thinking of the Bible as using irony or satire in that sense, but it is true, as God says in Psalm 2, that he who looks on the rebels laughs. I mean, they're fools, and God doesn't have to work very hard to take a Haman and toss him from his high position. And in the process, God encourages us to laugh with him, as it were, at the conceit. I'm going to come back to that point. Second of all, we should marvel how God, and I've already mentioned this, but I want to say a little bit more about this, how God gets glory using the evil intentions of men. Now, our pastor preached through Isaiah, and we saw how the nation of Assyria was seeking to destroy the nation of Israel and also attacking Judah. And they had their own intent, but God had his purposes. And that's the sort of thing that's going on here. Haman wasn't there so that he could further redemptive history. Okay, he wasn't conscious of saying, I want to see how I can honor the people of God. Obviously, he wanted to execute Haman. He wanted to execute Mordecai instead. But God, in his wisdom, has his own ways of advancing his purposes. And I thought I would read, Trapp is quite quotable on this chapter, but I cut out a bunch of quotes. Here's what Trapp says about this point. See here, as in a mirror, how the Lord, by a secret providence, bringeth about and overruleth the wiles of men, their affairs, times, counsels, words, and speeches, to the fulfilling of his own will and decree. And this, when they think least of doing God's will or serving his providence. So here's Haman. He's there bright and early, the first guy in the court for his own purposes. But God completely turns it around and uses it for his purposes. And the third point, I said, we can laugh with God at the comic scene here, but when we see someone whose natural reaction is, whom would the king delight to honor more than me, we need to hear a little bells going off on our heads. This is the danger of conceit. Okay, pride leads to this sort of self-conceit, which says, the king must have me in mind. Okay? I mean, you can just hear, sorry, everyone under 40, ignore this part. You can just hear Carly Simon singing, "You're so vain, you probably think this song is about you." So that's, when Haman hears these words, he says, oh, it's all about me. It's always all been about me. So forget the Carly Simon, but here's what Matthew Henry says in application to us. The deceitfulness of our own hearts appears in nothing so much as in the good conceit we have of ourselves and of our own performances, against which we should therefore constantly watch and pray. So that our hearts are deceitful, that's a basic teaching of Scripture in Jeremiah, but he says they appear in nothing so much as in the good conceit we have of ourselves and our own performances, our own deeds. So, I'll have to confess, sometimes in my own mind you hear things and you say, oh, well, this is how wonderful I am and so on. Then, of course, it had nothing to do with me. It's completely ridiculous, okay? And maybe you've had similar thoughts. So, while we laugh, let us also remember that we ourselves can be tempted to the same conceit. And there is an implicit warning here to us. Let's look a little bit more at some of the details here, and then I'll pause and see if you have comments or questions on this part. One interesting contrast to see how Haman asks or answers the king's question in verse 7 is that he doesn't use the typical courteous language. Like Esther had received an offering in chapter 5, up to half my kingdom, and Esther gives all this courteous sort of language you're supposed to use to the king. If you find favor in the king's sight, if it pleases the king. Haman just says, for the man the king delights to honor. He's so filled up with himself, he doesn't even bother to use that typical request. Now, if you think about Haman and the situation he's in, he's in essence the second in command in the kingdom. There's not much more he could ask for, right? If it's not like a commoner where he could ask for a little extra riches or something like this. He's already chummy with the emperor, as it were. And so what he really asks for is to be identified further with the king, okay, to promote his relationship with the king. Some commentators think maybe he wants to look like the king, and maybe that's what he aspires to. So he wants the royal robe, he wants the horse on which the king is ridden, and the royal crest on its head. He wants this to be proclaimed throughout the city square, that this is what is done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And of course, the ironic thing is that if Ahasuerus had asked anyone else in the kingdom, they wouldn't have come back with an answer like that, right? I mean, this is a guy who's already at the top, so he has to go, we might say, over the top here. And the irony is that all of this lavish honor, which no one else, certainly Mordecai, would never have asked for, comes on his enemy, Mordecai, instead. Okay? So the great thing, the pious thing that he could think of, comes on someone else instead. Just a point here, and I guess maybe Bridget's probably helping with the kids. I thought maybe Bridget already knows this, but the reference at the end of verse 8 to the royal crest placed on the head is in fact referring to the horse's head. And there is archaeological evidence they put something like a royal turban on the horse's head and rode it around. Maybe this is in movies I've never seen or anything, but that's the way they did it. So the whole picture is intended to say, this guy is so close to the king that you can give him the honor that's due to the king. That's the picture. Now, in the end, of course, Haman, after going through all of this, in verse 11, it says, sorry, actually I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Yeah, let me pause there and see what comments or questions you have at this point. Yes, Dave.
You mentioned how, you know, we are to laugh when we read this account and we know what's coming. That's exactly how God designed the chapter to be understood. But there's also a danger in thinking of this as what happened to the Jews in terms of this is a story about other people. Mm-hmm. Now, earlier in the book, you emphasized the importance of thinking of this as our story of God's people being redeemed.
Right.
And it's not just that God laughs at his enemies, but God writes things for us to laugh at our enemies, which are also his enemies. But the problem is that takes a great deal of faith to think of episodes today, how God might be laughing at the rulers of this world who have set themselves up against his people. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's easy to look at Haman and say, well, sure, we see in the nick of time things roll together and God saves his people and we all leave with a hurrah at the end, and the way the Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim now is, you know, characteristic of that. But do we actually believe that this is one of the ways God will deliver us today, or our brothers in China?
Right.
Something along those lines. It's a very easy lesson to think about other people being delivered this way and being able to laugh. But for Mordecai, there was no laughter for quite a while in this story.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
And it seems to me to be very, very difficult to apply to ourselves. It takes a great deal of faith to believe that this really is our story, not just their story.
Excellent. Very good point. Yes, that's right. Good.
I have a question on verse 10. When the king's telling Haman to go do all this stuff for Mordecai.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows that Mordecai's also a Jew?
Apparently he does.
That's kind of interesting. So go honor this guy before you kill him.
Did he know yet that the Jews were
the ones? See, you know, things may not have filtered back into the throne room. when the proposal was made by Haman, Haman never told him that he was going to exterminate the Jews. He just said there was a certain people. Now, the rest of the empire knew that it was the Jews. But even Esther needed to be told by Mordecai what was going on. So it could be that, as happens elsewhere in the book, Ahasuerus is clueless. It could be. Yeah. Or maybe he just didn't put two and two together. The guy hadn't slept all night or something. I don't know. But it does. That is a very good question, because it highlights the irony of this, right? You know, here we are. Here's Haman, the enemies of the Jews, the enemy of the Jews, and now I want you to go honor Mordecai the Jew. So it does highlight that point. Yeah. And it could be that he knew Mordecai was a Jew because that was in the Chronicles. Like the record actually said that. So, yeah. Good. Other questions?
Did he ever know that it was the Jews? Because even Esther says to save my people, she never says that they're Jews.
I think eventually he put two and two together, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, indirectly, she revealed also her connection with Mordecai, I think, at the same point, that we're getting ahead of the story a little bit. So eventually, you know, he might have figured out, oh, that's your cousin, so that means, you know. But, yeah. You know, emperors, they got 127 provinces. They got a lot on their mind. You know, they can't keep track of all these small points. Who are we exterminating today? You know? It's really not completely clear, but it seems like Ahasuerus doesn't keep track of things. Maybe that's true to life. I don't know. Okay. Verses 12 through 14, then, sort of a short conclusion to the chapter, but still quite telling. It says the reaction to this event. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. Now, we're maybe not surprised at Haman's reaction. After all, in the last chapter, when Mordecai refused to stand up in his presence, he was pouting and complaining. And so here, he's mortified. I'll come back to that point. But we may be overlooking Mordecai's reaction. Again, lots of commentators point on this. Mordecai seems to be relatively unaffected by this. Goes back to work. You know? What work has piled up since I've been riding around on this stupid horse? You know, that maybe that's his reaction to it. But it's quite a striking contrast, and it's the same very artfully done. This is a masterful writer, just like, you know, you see Haman and Ahasuerus sitting down to drink, and the whole city is perplexed. So here's a very striking contrast. Mordecai, who's just been called nearly equal to the king, goes back to his job. Yeah, got stuff to do, and Haman is undone. We're not surprised at that, but that's the same. Same sort of contrast. And I thought Trapp put very well why Haman should feel undone. And I thought I'd read. This is a longer quote from Puritan commentator Trapp. When he's actually going back, pointing back to the verse when Ahasuerus says, do so, this is the one that J.D. was referring to, do so for Mordecai the Jew. This word, Trapp says, this word stabbed Haman to the heart, who had run many great hazards, doubtless, to domineer in his undeserved dignities, and now must perforce honor him whom he had hoped to have hanged, clothe him whom he had hoped to have stripped, help him up to his horse upon whose grave he hoped to have danced, prepare a triumph for him for whom he had prepared a tree, make proclamation before him as a crier, lead his horse as a lackey, do all offices for him as a slave or underling. Oh, what a cut, what a grief of heart was this to a man of his mettle and making. It was wonder his heart burst not. And that says, you know, very well that the sense that his whole world is crashing down on him. And, you know, we can sort of enter into that. We can see maybe some of the, like, schoolyard envy or whatever. But remember the discussion in the last chapter. Prestige is Haman's idol. He worships prestige. This is his God cast down. He has to honor the lowest person he knew of, who is Mordecai the Jew. It's a terrible thing for him. Let's look at one reference that I think will be helpful also in our later discussion. Turn to Revelation chapter 3. There aren't a lot of cross references except in a very general sense from Esther elsewhere. But I want to read Revelation 3 because there's a promise that Jesus makes to, obviously, a New Testament church, to the church in Philadelphia, who is suffering, and he says we'll suffer, we'll go through the hour of trial. Revelation 3:9, indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. So here's the same sort of reversal that we see with Haman and Mordecai. The one who had sought to kill Mordecai is made instead, in essence, to come and worship before his feet and to know that God loved him. Now, as commentators on Revelation point out, of course, the great irony is that here it's the Jew persecuting the Christian. And I want to come back to that point later on and if we have time. But this is just an example of many references we see in the Psalms where God takes the plot of the enemy and completely turns it over. The pit that he dug for the others to fall in, he falls in himself. And we'll see more of that in the next chapter, so maybe I won't talk about that as much today. Yeah, but then the rest of the verses, the last part of 12 through 14, we have these miserable comforters are ye all. Is that what Job says? Anyway, we have these the reappearance of Zeresh and Haman's friends to counsel him. And here they sing a rather different tune. Okay? And I made a comment about this before. Before, at the end of chapter 5, it was, Mordecai's in your way, just execute him. You're second in command. Do whatever you want. But now they say, if Mordecai before whom you have begun to fall is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. Now, why the change here? Well, people often go with the winning side, and maybe that's the explanation. But I think there's something to the suggestion that people like Zeresh and the friends of Mordecai, of Haman, keep confusing them today, sorry, are often superstitious people. So they saw this day as sort of a bad omen for Haman. So you, before you, whom you have begun to fall, the wheels of fate are already in motion, and it's helpless for you to resist. That may be the sort of thing that's behind this. And certainly they had seen how God had preserved people like Daniel and his friends earlier. So at this point it would be like 40 or 50 years earlier, but that God had been quite able to preserve his people against the attacks of the empire, and it may be that they had the history of that sort of thing in mind. But it is often true that that the pagan and the unbeliever is more ready to recognize the hand of God than God's people are. One commentator referred to the incident of the Philistines and the golden tumors. Remember when they got the ark? And they seemed to have a better idea of the significance of the ark and what was going on than God's people did, who thought that they could use it as a rabbit's foot to take it with them into war. And that is a striking thing. Here God uses Zeresh and Haman's friends as sort of his mouthpiece to say, it's all over, Haman. And what they say is true, whether they meant it in a superstitious way or not, is not completely clear. But we know, and that's an important contrast between the pagan worldview and our worldview, we know it's not just the wheels of fate. We don't look at bad omens and say, this is my unlucky day, things are going to go against me. The reason that they can't stand against the Jews is that God has made a covenant to protect his people. And God's covenant word will stand sure. It's not fate in the abstract or some far-off God who is detached from the world, but it is a God who loves his people and has a sovereign purpose to accomplish his promises to care for his people. Now, that's the clear implication of the whole of Scripture. It's a belief in the God of Israel as opposed to some goddess of fate. And then the last verse is, we might sort of pass over, but what's striking about this, just as they're talking to him, the kings come and pull him away. There's no chance for Haman really to think about what he's just been told. No chance for him to repent of where he is. He has really no opportunity for reflection. It's as if he's brought to the situation that will send him back to his own gallows, which is what, of course, happens in chapter 7. So Haman, sure enough, cannot stand against God's people, and God gives him, in essence, no time to think about his situation, but he's rushed on to the accusation and his downfall. I want to make a comment here, and again, I guess I've had sort of technical footnotes at the end of some of these classes. I want to make a comment here about the reference to Mordecai being of Jewish descent in verse 13. And I've again and again, when I've talked about how the book of Esther applies to us, and Dave already mentioned this, is that we should think of this as our story. And that's based on a covenantal understanding of the scriptures, that this is not simply a story about the Jews as an ethnic people, so that it would have no relevance to us. It's our story because we have been grafted in to that ancient people with whom God had made the promise. God has fulfilled the promise in the Messiah. All the nations are blessed. We are among the nations who are gathered in. And I want to make a couple of points, and I want to tie them together. But there may be a temptation, even in certain parts of the evangelical Christian world. I wouldn't say it's a superstitious view of the Jews, but there is sort of a tendency to misinterpret these references to the Jews as referring strictly to an ethnic people and as not having relevance to God's people. So I want to say a little bit about that, and for that, let's turn to Romans chapter 11. I use the phrase grafting in purposely because that's the language that Paul uses in Romans 11. Remember, in Romans 9 through 11, Paul especially focuses on the question of how his people, he is a Jew ethnically, and how his people are situated in this time with the coming of the Messiah. He was greatly grieved, so much that he was really calling down a curse on himself if he could save his people. He was greatly grieved that for the most part the Jews had rejected the gospel. And so in Romans 9 through 11, he talks about how that rejection was not complete. He himself was one of the remnant who believed in the Messiah. And then he also talks about how that rejection is not final, that in the end God will restore many among the nations to himself. That, by the way, that convenient outline of is due to John Murray. It's a really helpful way to remember what Paul is saying in Romans 9 through 11. Not complete and not final. But before I get to that point more specifically, when Paul is talking to the Gentiles and warning them not to be haughty, did I say verse 24? Let me back up. Let's go back to verse 17 of Romans 11. Maybe I didn't give you a verse at all. Paul says, and if some of the branches were broken off, he's referring to the branches of those who have worshipped God in all ages, restricted almost entirely to the Jewish people in the Old Testament. If some of the branches were broken off and you being a wild olive tree were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree, do not boast against the branches. But if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said, because of unbelief they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. Therefore consider the goodness and severity of God. On those who fell, severity, but toward you, goodness, if you continue in his goodness, otherwise you also will be cut off. And they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these who are natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree? For I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion. He will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. I guess I'll stop there. I actually read more than I planned to, but it's a great passage. So there are two points I want to make from this. First of all, this justifies our reading Esther as our story. Okay? Because the Gentiles are grafted in. They are, their root is the same root as Esther and Mordecai's root, because they were grafted into that same olive tree of worship of the one true God. And that's why it's not improper for us to think of ourselves as being, well, children of Abraham, as Paul says elsewhere, or of applying to ourselves the promises that God will not let his witness fail in the earth. So Jesus says in Matthew 16 that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. That's really the same argument that God will preserve his witness, the same hope that Mordecai had when he said help will come from somewhere else. He believed that God would deliver his people. So that's the first point. And that means that when you read what Zeresh and her friends say, well, if Mordecai is of Jewish descent, you can't stand against him. You shouldn't develop this sort of superstitious view that, the Jews are the only ones that God cares about. No, God, in describing the New Testament believer who is a Gentile, is saying that that's part of our heritage also. That's part of our identity. Christ rules with a special care. He is head over all things for his church. So that's one point I want to make, and I think that's very important for us to remember when we read, anytime we read the Old Testament, as Paul said to the partly Gentile church of Corinth, these things happen to our fathers, okay? And they are examples for us. And that's true of whenever we read the Old Testament. So that's one point. But on the other hand, I think it is true that God has promised here in Romans 9 through 11 that he will restore the Jews on a large scale to faith in him. This is a point of interpretation that not all Reformed people have agreed on. However, our larger catechism, for example, says that we should pray for the calling of the Jews, which the article the is important there because it means something on a larger scale than just that individual Jews would be converted. And I think Paul is here, under the inspiration of the Spirit, referring to a large-scale ingathering of the Jews. I didn't read, for example, the verses that preceded verse 17, but God talks about the acceptance of the Jews being life from the dead. Now, if that's the case, then presumably it means that Hitler is going to fail when he tries to exterminate the Jews because they haven't been converted to him. Okay? I mean, you can draw implications from that God still has a purpose for his ancient people, and a large part of the Puritan history of prayer for missions was to pray for the conversion of the Jews and to expect that God would work that way in history. So I guess I would say when you read something like what Zeresh and her friends said, well, realize they weren't Bible scholars, okay, but when they talk about Mordecai being of Jewish descent, you should realize that the promise applies to the whole church, but God has promised also to remember the Jews and to restore them. And we should pray against those who seek to destroy them. And we should also pray as the implication was. So now I'll come back to Revelation 3, right? What Jesus actually says is that those who claim to be Jews but are really a synagogue of Satan, and they're a synagogue of Satan because they're persecuting the church, they will acknowledge that God has loved you, which could be seen as a promise of judgment on them, or perhaps as a promise of conversion, that they recognize that God's work is among them. It's as often sort of a two-edged sword. So I think as we read this and we think about the Jews in our own day, we shouldn't simply think that God has preserved them for their own sake so that he'll have Jews around, but that God has preserved them so that we can tell them about Christ and we can pray that they will be gathered in. It's not so that they can have a lot of missiles funded by the U.S. government or something like that. I'm not making a political statement. Okay, this is politically neutral. But it is something that I think we should recognize. The primary application in Esther, end of long footnote, the primary application of Esther is to God's preserving the church in our own day, if we want to apply it to ourselves. But we should remember that he still has a promise of the ingathering of the Jews. Okay, that was longer than the tropological comment last time. Any comments or questions or further thoughts on Esther 6, if anyone remembers what that was about before I started that long aside? Any comments on Esther 6 or Romans 11 or something like that? Yes.
I have a request.
Uh-huh.
This tension between God's sovereignty and understanding God's sovereignty and understanding the difference between that and faith is kind of a fine line. I'm wondering if you could talk a little more about that so we could be aware when we've gone over the edge in error.
Right. A good contrast would be to think of the difference between Allah and Islam and the God of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So there are stories, and I think maybe Scott has told stories like this, that in the Muslim world you come across an automobile accident and there's the guy lying on the side of the road dying. Allah has decreed it. You drive on. Okay? In the biblical worldview, you say, God decreed the accident, but God also uses means to deliver, and I have a responsibility here. So, in biblical terms, one aspect of providence is the recognition that God uses means, and that he has given us his revealed will to know how we should act in a situation. And his providential will, his decree, doesn't somehow overrule our responsibilities. If we should say, well, God decreed the accident, that means my responsibility to care for my neighbor has gone out the window. So that's one aspect of it, which I think is maybe a more concrete way to think of it. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the situation in Esther and, whether these guys were really so superstitious is not maybe completely clear, but there's a sense of the impersonal nature of the universe. Fate has her own concerns. And fate is like the ancient Greek gods. They're not really concerned about people. They're not really concerned about the affairs of men. They're just quarreling with each other, and sometimes they use people for their own ends. But that's not it's not blind fate. It's a God who knows and loves. It's a personal God who has called a people to himself and is working out means to save a people. So that's another aspect of it. It's not blind and impersonal, but it's Yahweh, the God who has made covenant with his people. And that's a very great part of the comfort of providence, is that it's a loving face shining on us, even in the midst of trials. So Mordecai could say, they overlooked me for all the care that I had done, but I believe in a God who cares for me, and so I'll keep serving faithfully. And that makes a huge difference in the way we live. That's another aspect of it. Maybe other people want to add more.
I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
Sometimes you'll hear Christians say things like, I did such and such. I chose to do X, Y, Z. So it must have been God's providence that it would happen. So this must be God's plan.
Yeah.
And that the Bible doesn't really talk about X, Y, Z very much.
Yeah.
If at all.
Uh-huh.
And it may in fact be that this person has done X, Y, Z in an unwise manner.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
How do we respond to that sort of thing?
I would direct them to www.stillwaterrpc. So Dan study before this is a very helpful, I think, in distinguishing, the will of decree, the will, the precepts, his commands, and then the things that we too often want to pull into the other categories that for which we should just do something. We should use sanctified wisdom.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
Yeah.
It really was, I think, very, very helpful in separating out those aspects and not trying to import God's blessing on what shoes I wear, you know, that sort of thing. Which in my case is really important. But
yeah.
Holes in.
I think it's really something in there, but it seems to me that trying to sanctify sinful choice by saying, well, it must be God's will, is not appropriate.
Yeah, and it's very tempting. It really is, I think. Conscience may have something to do with it, you know, that need to retroactively say it was a good thing. Okay. Well, let's close in prayer.